Welcome and thank you for joining us at Behind the Trial, a Benchmark Litigation podcast that features in-depth discussions with the nation's most iconic trial lawyers.
In this episode of Behind the Trial, we talk with award-winning trial lawyer Diane Sullivan of Weil Gotshal. Diane brings 3 decades of trial experience to the interview, sharing her insight as a specialist in trials involving antitrust, class action, consumer fraud, patent, and product liability matters, particularly in the pharmaceutical space. Diane is the recipient of many awards and honors, including American Lawyers Litigator of the Year, and has been a consistent member of Benchmark Litigation's Top 10 Women in Litigation Honors. She has been featured for her trial victories on the front pages of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, in addition to frequent coverage in prominent legal publications across the United States.
Diane, thank you so much for being here today. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, this is a podcast about trials, and it's about getting behind the headlines of trials and getting down into what actually works and doesn't work when you're in front of a jury or a judge and finding out the real stuff of persuasion. And I'm particularly delighted to be here with you today because you, believe it or not, you are the first, what I might call, pharma litigator. I realize that's just one of your areas, but pharma litigators to come and talk to us at Behind the Trial. And I guess for those who don't know what I mean when I say pharma litigator, what is it? I mean, would you characterize yourself that way?
It certainly has been a big part of my trial practice over the decades. I've been doing trial work for, I shouldn't say this, people guess my age, but over 30 years. And I have represented many pharmaceutical companies in mass tort litigation, in patent litigation, and in commercial contract litigation. I got my start doing a lot of mass tort work, including for pharma companies, which gets sued a fair amount in jurisdictions around the country, and cut my teeth in the trial bar starting in pharmaceutical mass tort work.
Okay, well, let's break that down a little bit for those of us who don't know. What is the pharmaceutical mass tort work?
So pharmaceutical companies make a variety of products, medicines, some over-the-counter products, some consumer products, and when there are adverse events with those products, sometimes they get sued for personal injury or class action lawsuits, and often there are jury trials. And occasionally there are mass torts. In other words, there's plaintiffs from all over the country who bring suit, and the suits can mount to a few hundred, thousands. The Vioxx litigation I handled many years ago, it was over 50,000 lawsuits.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
And so there are trials. There can be trials in jurisdictions around the country.
How do you handle 50,000 lawsuits at one time?
Well, you don't. You don't. you have a virtual law firm where you have lawyers from around the country working together to defend the company in the various lawsuits.
Now, in a case like that or cases like that, are you, you know, involved through all phases of the case? I mean, how
That's
could you
a really
be involved
good
in
question.
So,
so when I started my career, and one of the things you learn as you go forward is how can you add the most strategic value for your client? When I started, I thought you needed to do every, you know, to be the best lawyer possible, you needed to be involved in every single aspect of a case. And my specialty is trial work. And so where there are key decisions that may impact the outcome of a trial, I become involved in those selection of who's going to tell the company's story, who's going to be the corporate witnesses on the stand,
right?
Who are going to be your experts, what motions should be filed.
Sort of the strategic things.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the great things about representing pharmaceutical companies is they do a lot of great work. They discover medicines that have been life-changing for many people. And there are some great scientists who work hard every day to try to discover the next cure for cancer or Alzheimer's or MS. And so you've got some great people to choose from as your company witnesses. The reality is that all medicines have risks, even things that we think are benign, like aspirin. Aspirin has been a wonderful drug for a lot of people. Some people have terrible reactions to aspirin. Penicillin has cured diseases across the globe, but many people have died from adverse reaction to penicillin. And so there's no medicine that is without side effects.
Is it hard to represent be in a case on either side, doesn't matter which side, where there's been somebody who's died.
You wouldn't be human if your heart didn't ache for people who have suffered severe injuries or problems. But that's separate from the issue of whether the company failed to warn or whether the product caused injury.
And is what you just said a way that you approach it thematically at trial? That's what I'm getting towards. Do you acknowledge the difficulty of the personal story and then try and talk about the other? Tell us about that.
And one of the things in representing, in fact, it's harder. So I represent a variety of companies that have done antitrust work. I've represented ESPN in contract disputes. Pharmaceutical personal injury suits or personal injury suits in general are unique in that you've got this enormous sympathy factor. And one of the challenges as a defense lawyer is how do you embrace that and make the jury understand that it's absolutely normal. Of course, you're going to feel sympathy. Who wouldn't? We wouldn't be human if we didn't. But you've got this hard job to try to, the court will give the jurors an instruction that you have to, in deciding the case, set sympathy aside. You can't decide a case on sympathy or bias or prejudice. And so to educate jurors is that it's normal to feel for somebody who's been injured. But you've got the hard job of putting that aside and taking a hard look at the evidence and deciding the case based on the evidence.
Well, how did you decide to get into this?
Trial work,
yeah.
So when I was in law school, like many law students, or like some anyway, I had no idea what kind of law I wanted to practice. And I was at University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and they brought the public defender's office in to teach the law students a mock trial course.
What a great way to do it.
And these are men and women, and back then there were virtually no women trial lawyers in terms of role models. So I see these terrific women and men who were doing it, you know, in the trenches every day and teaching us and kind of going through mock trials in the criminal system and how cross-examining witnesses, doing opening statements. And I was, wow, this is terrific. I would love to be a trial lawyer.
And did you have them in your past, you know, in your family and sort of
as
a younger person?
I was the first person in my family to go to college, so no lawyers back there. But the other part of trial work that that interests me, I was a big sports fan. I loved playing tennis, and I had two sisters. My father would make us race each other and compete. So trial work it's a sport. There's unlike a lot of practices like corporate work. You do a deal, nobody really knows who won or lost. Trial work, you generally know there's a winner and there's a loser, and you know for crazy reasons that attracted the competitive strategy part of trial work attracted me.
And then when you got into it, I take it you loved it.
I loved it.
You know, are there particular traits that you found that make for being a great trial lawyer?
Yes.
Is there a type?
There's no type, and everybody has their own style, but a passion for what you're, picking out the lawyers that are the best of class, a passion for the profession, a commitment to excellence. There's no substitute for hard work. There is absolutely no substitute for not knowing before you step in the courtroom every fact, every issue. It's sort of like a play that you've already choreographed in your mind that you should know what the next move's going to be in every aspect of the case. Sometimes there's surprises, but
I was going to say, it's a play where people are trying to get you.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes there's surprises, but you try to make sure that you prepare and you know enough that those are few and far between. So
preparation, passion, those are
commitment
key
traits. To excellence. There is a, I don't know if the word is courageous, but it's sort of not being afraid to mix it up when you need to for your clients, to be a fierce advocate. And the best trial lawyers, you go in there, you do your best. If you lose, you shake it off and you don't give it another thought. I mean, you help your client to try to, get the verdict thrown out on an appeal, et cetera. But in terms of your neck, when you walk into the courtroom to try the next case, you don't even think about it.
What would you say to young lawyers who are thinking about being trial lawyers? Is it something you're born with, this sort of passion and competitiveness, or are there traits that you can learn? Because people talk about this a lot with the decline of the jury trial these days.
Yes, and it's a scary, I know the plaintiff's bar talks a lot about it, but it's one thing we can agree on that in my view, and I should have made clear, and you guys will, I don't speak for my clients, I don't speak for my law firm,
sure.
But in my personal view, the jury system is the cornerstone of our free society, and I have been around the country. Sometimes judges are have very strong views one way or the other, or have affinities for certain lawyers, or there's a political system where the judges are elected and there's contributions pouring in from a certain side. And so sometimes the judges are not, I've been before some of the best judges you could ever dream of. I've also been before some of the worst judges you could ever imagine. But one thing that has been refreshing is the jury system, because you take people from off the streets who typically have no agenda. I mean, most of them don't want to be there. You get your summons in the mail and you got to show up. And they, and once they're sworn in, an amazing thing happens. They actually, for the most part, really take their job seriously. I mean, they want to get it right. They want to pay attention. They want to do justice. And it is the most refreshing thing about our justice system to see regular people from all walks of life actually commit to trying to do justice in a fair and decent way.
Does it work? Can they get there?
They, you know, I know that there's...
do they get there, I guess, is really the question.
You know, I will say that most jurors I've been before have got it right. You know, it's just, even in complicated cases, even in cases with a lot of sympathy. I mean, sometimes the judges will throw it out. Sometimes the judges put their thumbs on the scale that are, in ways that are inappropriate. But the jurors, for the most part, they try to do the right thing. And that, you know, I may be unique because... some lawyers would prefer to have a bench trial.
Well, that's just what I was going to ask you about.
I would take a jury trial, you know, most days of the week.
The because you think about some of the types of cases, you know, there, you could think about it in the pharma cases where there's a lot of technical information, or sometimes a lot of people in the patent bar will say, oh, you know, juries, they can't understand
the technical. Well, some patent cases, you don't get a jury trial. You have to have a bench trial. And some you do. But yes, it's, but one of the, and you know this, having done it as well, one of the challenges for trialers is how to make it simple, how to take the most complicated, and it's sort of the fun part of what we do, the most complicated stuff, and make it simple for people off the street who aren't engineers or scientists to understand, what's going on in the case, and using analogies, using demonstratives, using all kinds of ways to simplify the complex is part of the fun of our work, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something you're particularly known for, and something I'd like to talk about in terms of when you're looking at a case, how do you, it's one thing to say, boil it down, but if it's an extremely complicated case, do you have a process you go through in trying to figure out how to do it simply, or some tools that you use?
Yes. Well, I'm not, you know, I'm not blessed to be an engineer or a scientist. So, and I have some family members who are sort of, you know, have, my brother-in-law is a mechanic. My sister was a bartender. My other sister works in a school system. And so sometimes I'll throw, I'll give them a complex issue and say, you know, how, and I'll get some help from them.
Yeah.
I get some help from just, you know, from regular, you know, we all grew up in life to try to figure out how to simplify things. And I've had the good fortune of working with some terrific graphics people who can come up with demonstratives that are, have been really fun and helpful. And I mean, what am
I? A demonstrative meaning what?
Like a graphic or a cartoon or one of my, because trials can be, people think trials are so interesting. A lot of them are deathly boring. So one of, one of my instructions to young lawyers is, be anything, but don't be boring. You know, try to be any, but don't be boring, because you'll want to keep their attention.
Well, let's talk about an example from one of your cases that I think would be interesting. A famous case that you handled was this ESPN Dish Network case.
Yes.
And I read something that really caught my interest. Is it right that in the closing argument, you showed pictures of Alice in Wonderland?
Alice in Wonderland, yes.
How did you use the graphics with Alice in Wonderland to tell the story without, I imagine, you could do it in a way that would get a judge aggravated at you, and you obviously didn't do it. How did you weave it in?
Well, it was closing argument, and so they typically, you have some leeway in what you can do in closing argument. And we put, you know, we put some of their arguments up and against the contract, and we had things popping on the screen and disappearing, and
meaning the graphics
coming
of the characters on the screen with
had,
the contract.
Sure, we had the Looking Glass, we had Alice, we had all of the Mad Hatter came, and we had a lot of different people appearing during the closing. So the jury was laughing, and then we had some fun, and we ended up getting a good result.
So you have tried some of the jury practice. Why don't you tell our listeners what that is generally?
Yeah, so for those who may not know, there's There's a process called a mock trial where the plaintiff's bar, the defense bar, or even a commercial case, either side can test out their themes or their arguments in front of people off the street. You have a consultant, and there's some very good ones that can profile what your likely jury is going to look like in terms of demographics and pick a comparable version of that. Sometimes you learn a lot. I had a case where I thought the defense theme that was being proposed was absolutely ridiculous. It would never sell, but I agreed to test it. The jury bought it hook, line, and sinker. We mm-hmm. went with it. Turned out to be a defense verdict. So yeah. I found it a helpful exercise.
Let's come back after a quick break to our interview with trial lawyer Diane Sullivan. Visit benchmarklitigation.com for comprehensive rankings and analysis covering litigation firms and attorneys across the United States, Canada, Latin America, Europe, and Asia. Benchmark also hosts a series of conferences that deliver insight and analysis to in-house and general counsel, connecting them with the leading litigators in their markets. BenchmarkLitigation.com. Join us next time for a conversation with legendary trial lawyer Gary Naftalis. Now let's return to our interview with trial lawyer Diane Sullivan.
It seems like there's a time to, what I've noticed is there's a time to put a lot of stock in it, like you said, with this defense argument that you tried out and you had no idea that it would resonate.
Yes.
And then there's times when you think to yourself, that's not going to, you know, that mock jury may have said that or thought that, but that's not going to work. And how do you, I guess the magic question is, how do you know which is which?
You know, it's interesting you raise that because I've had jury in both sides in big cases use jury consultants to do jury selection. Mm-hmm. And I have disagreed with jury consultants on selections. And I've had one jury consultant that I don't use anymore say to me, you're going to have a hard time defending keeping, you know, there was two jurors I kept. Both turned out to be great jurors for me.
And yeah.
But I remember I'm like, well, it's, you know, ultimately it's the client and my ass on the line and I'm going to overrule this jury consultant because I've got a good gut feeling about this juror. It turned out I was right on that score. I don't do that often, but sometimes we put too much, both sides, emphasis on all of this witchcraft and consultants and, you know, there's a whole cottage industry around mm-hmm. trials for both sides. But jury trials really boil down to human interaction at its base. And sometimes you're a better judge of that in your experience than all these consultants that come in.
Well, you know, there are all kinds of different tools that trial lawyers have, right? There's openings and closings mm-hmm. and crosses. There's a whole, we could go on forever about all the pretrial stuff that
right.
happens, exhibits. You know, when you look at your experience in trials, what has been the most important or most effective, if you were to pick one or two areas?
What has been the most effective? Interesting. So cross-examination is a great unraveler of the truth. Mm-hmm. We've got experts that sound great and they tell a great story. Mm-hmm. And if you can effectively dismantle them in a short time, I think that's a great tool. And closing argument, I mean, that's your last best chance, right? So, I've always said, keep me, you know, within striking distance by the time we get to closing and, you know, hopefully I can get you there because, that's your last chance to really drive your message home.
Well, I mean, closings, I've read a bit about you in closings. You're famous for closing arguments.
Or infamous,
depending on which side you're on, I suppose. You know, one question that I think trial lawyers have is, can you really change minds at that point? I mean, some lawyers will tell you that, oh, everybody makes up their mind in openings and it's game over. But I hear you saying that keep me close because, and
yeah,
what
I've read that
and
you know, opening is really critical because they say 70% of people make up their mind in opening statements. I'm not sure that's true in the long case.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I have been involved in cases where you can see a big change in jurors' demeanor and attitude after closing arguments, jurors that you thought were against you. They're like, oh, wow, you know, now I've heard that, I'm focusing on. So I don't think it's never over till it's over, in my view.
Are there tools that you use in the earlier parts of the trial, say opening or I guess elsewhere, to try and keep that open-mindedness towards?
Yes. One of the challenges is if you're on the defense side is to tell the jury in opening, you know, the plaintiffs are lucky. They get to go first. They get to put on all their witnesses and their evidence. And we don't, you won't hear from us until later in the case. Can you just give us a chance before you make up your mind and wait to hear all, you know, both sides of the story.
And it's disarming.
Yes, and kind of wait for them to. And then the big advantage in some jurisdictions that the plaintiff's lawyer have is the rebuttal. They get to close, and then you close, and then they get to rebut your closing. And so one of the techniques is to make sure in, when you're in jurisdictions like that, that you take the sting out of that rebuttal, that you preview the rebuttal, that you ask the jury, you know, as he and I look forward to the day when my adversary is a woman. I've yet to try a case against a female trial lawyer. So you say, you know, you're going to hear from him X, Y, and Z. Ask yourself when he says that, does, you know, this, that. So they're thinking about what you're saying.
You're putting the questions in there.
Know, as he's doing his rebuttal to try to take the sting, because that's a big advantage. And a lot of when you get to do a closing and then a rebuttal, it's a huge advantage generally for the plaintiff's lawyer.
So much of what you say has got all these great chestnuts in them for trial lawyers. So I'm gonna allow us to detour because something you just said fascinates me. People don't like bullies and they don't like mean-spirited people. That's self-evidently true. What is the role of likability of you, of the trial lawyer in a trial? Now, and I don't mean just you, but I mean for other people, if you're not likable, I mean, is it always the likable lawyer, or sometimes is the unlikable lawyer effective? I mean, how does that play in?
Well, you are the messenger for your client, and so you'd like to, the jury, it's better if the jury likes you than if they don't.
That's a good way to look at it.
It's often better than that the judge likes you too, but sometimes that hasn't worked out for me. And so it's better if the jury likes you, if they're the fact finder. And just play it straight with them. I mean, if you're honest and you're credible and you play it straight and you deliver what you promise in the beginning and opening statements, they tend to be with you.
Well, you know, if you think about the jury sitting there, so much is going on, right? In the way non-specialists process issues, regular people.
And so it's become so different now with technology too. It used to be you were worried about having, you know, all kinds of graphics and computers. You were worried about looking too slick or too multimedia. Now, especially the millennials, to keep them even paying attention for more than a minute, you really have to, you know, you have to almost juggle and do, you know.
Does the likability thing make it easier? Is it as simplistic as if I like you, I want to rule in your favor? Or does it have something to do with the juror's ability to take in information from?
You have to have the evidence, and you have to show them that you have the evidence and deliver it to them in a way that they're receptive.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah, deliver it in a way that's receptive, that they understand, that this makes sense, that this fits with their worldview of things. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about trial work is you're part actress, you're part psychologist, you're part lawyer, you're communicator. It's a whole gladiator. It's a whole mishmash of.
Well, that is really you're down to the essence of what we're trying to learn about in the podcast, is how these different dynamics come into play. Let's talk about something really interesting, and that is you as a woman, trial lawyer. Mm-hmm.
I look forward to the day that no one notices that. Uh-huh. Right?
Well,
because you see these lists, you're like, oh, best women trial lawyer.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you say that. We debated long and hard about whether to talk about it. I felt like we would miss an opportunity to not talk.
No,
with
I'm happy
you.
To talk. And you know, it's interesting. One of the ways I got, and this goes back to the gender bias, you know, decades ago when I started, there were virtually no women. I mean, over 30 years ago, and even now, the challenge with diversity in the profession, if you don't see it, if people don't see it, you don't believe you can be it. And it's so important for a whole variety of reasons. Our jurors are more diverse. Our judges are more diverse. Clients are demanding diversity in their outside counsel, and it's critically important that the trial bar does more to promote diversity in our ranks. Not just women, African American, Hispanic, Asian, across the board. We just need more diverse trial lawyers because it's part of, you know, our juries. We need trial lawyers that look like our juries, trial lawyers that look like our bench. One of the challenges I faced over 30 years ago was that there were virtually no role models for me. There were no women trial lawyers that I knew of, but I was fortunate enough, and sometimes opportunity, you know, luck and opportunity have a lot to do with how you make out in your career. So the it was the old breast implant litigation decades ago, and the companies were combing the country for female trial lawyers, and there were very, very few of us. And I was fortunate enough to learn from them. I mean, I think there were three that the company that I defended found that were a generation ahead of me, and they were wonderful. I mean, in places that you wouldn't even think about, like Mississippi and somewhere in Colorado, somewhere in Alabama. And these were gals who, you know, back 40 or 50 years ago were lugging their briefcases to courts, you know, in podunk jurisdictions around the country and really trying cases. And I learned a ton from them. And they were really helpful to me in my career. And one of the things I've learned from them is pay it forward. And I was happy last year that one of my proteges, a terrific young female trial lawyer, was promoted to partner here at Weil Gotshal. And it's sort of like part of the circle. It's, you know, pay it forward. But we need to do more on the diversity front. It's actually shameful that the trial bar is not as, you know, in 2017 is still not.
What is it?
There's so few.
Is it the role model issue, or is there some embedded, I think part of it is
if you don't see it, you can't be it. I mean, there's very few. I mean, Ted Wells is a famous diverse trial lawyer. You know, there's me, there's Beth Wilkinson, there's a handful of women that have done well, but there's very.
How do you find your way?
The fact that you can count them right on your hand is
there's
shameful.
No question about it. And in terms of role models and being able to count them on your hand, you know, one of the challenges that would occur to me is finding your voice as a woman trial lawyer. How do you do that as a woman in terms of finding your voice?
And I was fortunate to find these women, you know, from various parts of the country who back in the, you know, what I'll call the dark ages had a significant amount of trial experience, but it's hard. And that's why I think, especially, you know, you see young lawyers now, they want to see people who look like them who are successful. And so I think, and it's changing. I mean, I think we've got some, a younger generation that's much more diverse, but I think we can still do better on that score.
Is it, do you these days still, or maybe we could talk about historical, see differences in how judges or opposing counsel treat you in trials? What are some, I mean, tell us about that.
Well, it's better now than it used to be, but, you know, I've been in courtrooms where the judges were tough on women, dismissive, sort of a kind of obvious.
Term I've heard is mansplaining.
Yes.
Have you heard that term?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly. I had a judge tell me once, Ms. Sullivan, you're pissing up a rope. I'm like, oh, judge, that might be hard for me. But okay.
Yeah. And do you see it with opposing counsel and just how you're handling the case?
I mean, when I used to walk into courtrooms when I was younger or depositions, they thought I was the court reporter.
Yeah.
I don't really get that much now, but it was back in the day you did.
Yeah. What advice would you give young women, young aspiring women trial lawyers in terms of how to get the experiences and make their way in this profession that fortunately still is so dominant?
Yeah, so one of the things I would tell them is that nobody cares more about your career than you do. And so make sure you're getting the opportunities that you need. And if you're not, you know, pester people or go somewhere, you know, if you want to be a trial lawyer, you need to try cases, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So if you're not getting trials, you need to fix that and try to go to the public defender's office, go to the U.S. attorney's office, go to a smaller firm, a personal injury firm, where you're getting on your feet experience. You need to, you know, it's no matter how smart or how brilliant you are, if you're not getting trial experience, you're never going to be able to be a great trial lawyer. And so one of the things I would tell young people, pro bono is a great way. We have a terrific pro bono practice here at Weil Gotshal, and I've seen some of our young lawyers get some terrific trial experience.
Well, before we end, we try and do something we call the lightning round of questions for you. And do you get nervous before trial?
I think anyone tells you that they don't isn't telling the truth. Sure, I think you do. I think less so than when I was, you know, 20-something, but you still do.
What hours do you keep at trial?
Being a trial lawyer is hard work. We work a lot at long. We work every weekend and mostly every night. Except we do usually take off Friday night for a few cocktails. But there's a lot of hard work during.
Are you a stay up late person?
I used to be, but now that I'm a little bit older, I don't stay up as late as I used to.
Yeah.
You know, it was funny. I have a funny story from the my first Vioxx trial. It'll date. We had a bunch of associates who happened to be female and a bunch of paralegals, and Grey's Anatomy had just come out, the show. And so we were working our tails off through that trial, but we had a hard stop every Thursday night for Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, no kidding.
Not sure our client knew that at the time, but we won the case. But that was like that 1 hour, everybody was watching Grey's Anatomy.
If you were in a room full of sixth graders, mm-hmm. and you were describing what it means to be a trial lawyer, mm-hmm. what would you say?
To make people understand the truth about your case and your client, to defend your client in a way that the jurors understand the truth.
If you weren't a trial lawyer, what would you be?
Well, I'd like to say a professional tennis player, but I was never that good, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure. That's a good question.
It's the competitor.
Flipping burgers at the Jersey Shore on the boardwalk. I don't know.
Diane, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for listening to Benchmark Litigation's Behind the Trial with Courtland Reichman. Connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, and at benchmarklitigation.com. You can also rate and review the show on iTunes.
Join us next time for a conversation with legendary trial lawyer Gary Naftalis.